Yep. I'll be right there. Just give me 1 second. I just got to check one thing here on SE Scoops before I head out. Look at this. Patrick Clark has signed a developmental deal with WWE. Man, how many of these tough enough people have they signed now? Let's see here. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Oh, my goodness! Everybody gets a
contract.
You get a
contract.
You get a
contract.
You get a
contract.
You get a
contract.
Everybody gets a
contract.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
They are just giving contracts out like candy to these tough enough kids. Yes, indeed. Patrick Clark has been signed to a WWE developmental deal. Mata has also been signed. He started at the Performance Center. Josh is already at the Performance Center. Sarah Lee is at the Performance Center. They've signed ZZ to a deal. Amanda, who is runner-up to Sarah Lee, is signed. She's going to be front and center on the next season of Total Divas. And they've also signed Daria to a deal. She was the one who came out as a lesbian during the show. Probably her big claim to fame. So that makes 7 of the 14 contestants now signed to WWE deals. Except Gigi, apparently. Where's Gigi's contract? She was the best woman of the bunch. And she gets no contract. And to the people asking, you know, why even have a show if they're just going to end up signing everybody anyway? I could think of 250,000 reasons why. Okay? There's a big difference between what Josh and Sarah Lee got and what all these other ones are getting. Only 2 of them got the big contract. The others have to start from the bottom and work their way up. I'm just having some fun with it. You know, I'm not knocking it. It's fine. They had 11,000 video submissions or something like that for the show. They narrowed it down to 14. So, obviously, the final 14 have some degree of talent, or they wouldn't have narrowed them down to the field the way they did. And they trained these people for, what, 10 weeks? You know, put them on television. You know, there's some talent there. So why cast them all away just because you can only pick 2 winners? So I don't fault them for it. I just think it's funny that this by far has to be the most number of people they've signed from any Tough Enough season ever. This is episode 406 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Hell in a Cell Sunday, October 25, 2015. I am the Solid Monster. The Mets swept the Cubs. They're going to the World Series. I'm excited. I'm pumped. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a second. I want to also mention here that we are continuing our 8-year anniversary countdown. The 8-year anniversary show coming up on Sunday, November 8th. Should be episode 408. And that will climax this little list I put together many weeks ago. Many, many weeks ago, I started this countdown. 8 of my favorite WWE matches of all time. These are not the 8, the only 8. But they're 8 of my favorites, in no particular order, of course. And just to recap here, match number 1, got to have the obligatory 1992 Royal Rumble mention. Match number 1 was Steve Austin against Dude Love from Over the Edge in 98. Match number 3 was Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker at WrestleMania 25. Match number 4 was Bret Hart against Mr. Perfect from The King of the Ring in 1993. And match number 5 was The Shield against the Wyatt family from Raw last month. No, I'm kidding. At the Elimination Chamber in 2014. That's something else we'll talk about later. It's kind of interesting how that worked out. Match number 6, which is coming up a little later on in the podcast here this week, is one of the all-time great matches in Raw history. It is the last tag team match that you will see here in this countdown, but it's one of my favorites. And it took place in the same city as Raw did this past Monday, Dallas, Texas, if that's a big enough hint for you. It also made my top 30 moments in Raw history list way back on Sound Off 228, another fine episode of the podcast if you ever want to go back in the archives and listen. So we'll get to match number 6 after the mailbag as usual. Don't forget, keep signing up for Audible with our link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. You can pass that link around to anybody that you think may get some use out of it. If they haven't already, you know, cashed in their free book, you sign up. It's a 30-day trial. You're under no obligation to keep going beyond the 30 days. If you want to cancel in that period, that's cool. You won't be billed. But you get one free audiobook no matter what. And that includes the Daniel Bryan book. That includes the Brock Lesnar book, which I'm going to make mention of a little bit later on. Because Brock Lesnar was on the Steve Austin podcast this past week and shared an interesting story. Actually did not really give away all that much about this story that I'm referring to, but apparently he did talk about it in his book, which I did read, and somebody reminded me about it. So if you want to listen to Brock Lesnar's book, you can actually use our Audible link to get it for free. So audibletrial.com/Solomonster. And also don't forget, we have our store on Pro Wrestling Tees. Thank you to everybody who made a PayPal donation. You can do so on the Solomonster.com. The PayPal box is on the right-hand side of the page. You can make a donation anytime, any day, any week. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. $30 or more will get you a nickname and a brief shout-out for your podcast, your YouTube channel, or what have you. So you can always include that information when you donate. So thank you to Out of Control, Cody Thomas. Happy birthday, buddy. Paul Money in the Banks. See what I did there, who I understand is also celebrating a birthday this week. So happy birthday, Paul. That's a great son that you have there. You have done a fine job. Deadpool, James Herrera. Case closed, Aaron Kloss. The Reflection of Perfection, Abraham Lara. Jerome, You're Going Down, Eugenio. John, Loose Cannon Lopez. Handsome Eric Guy. Sean, Nasty Boy Nilsson. The Scottish Assassin, Colin Kerr. And Montesi, Antoine Moore, who is host of the More to Life radio show. I've been on his show before. He's got a brand new song out today, October 25th. It's a new song for John Cena called Triumphant. It features Ocean Symphony. Antoine had released a song for Roman Reigns last year called Heart of a Warrior. It's a pretty damn good song. And he's actually very good with his music. Now he's got one for John Cena. You can check it out right now on SoundCloud. Go to soundcloud.com/MonteseMore. So it's MONTEASY, Moore with two O's. The first 100 downloads, you get the song for free. After that, you can listen only. You can also listen to the song right now on his YouTube channel, youtube.com/MessageMonteseTV. MessageMonteseTV is the place to go on YouTube. Check it out. I haven't actually listened to the song yet because it was dropping today as I'm recording this podcast, but as soon as I'm done with this, I'm going to go listen to the song myself, so I suggest you do the same. So like I was saying before, if I may go back to this briefly, and then we'll get to Hell in a Cell predictions, my Mets are going to the World Series for the first time in 15 years. It was a great series against the Cubs. I tell you what, there's been a ton of great postseason baseball. I think even if you're not a big baseball fan, I know some people find it just completely boring. They just don't like it. You know, hockey. I don't hate hockey, but I'm not a hockey fan. But if there's a fun, exciting hockey game going on, a close game, you know, I can get into it. And I feel like you don't have to be a big baseball fan to watch some of these games and just get sucked up into everything that's going on. There's been a lot of great baseball so far this postseason. And even though we did sweep the Cubs, they were a tough team, not taking anything for granted. Now it's the Mets against Kansas City, Kansas City Royals, a lot of blue coming up in the World Series. And I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm sure it's going to be a great series, and I'm looking forward to it. It starts on Tuesday. And I have to give a shout-out to Kay Thizzle on Twitter for giving me this idea. He said, hey, what you should do on your show this week, you should talk about what was going on back in October of 2000. The last time the Mets were in the World Series, it was the Subway Series against the Yankees. I try to put that out of my mind as far as what happened there. And I said to myself, you know, that's actually not a bad idea. So I thought I would take a few minutes here to talk a little bit about what was going on in October of 2000. Now, I can tell you that back then, I had just started my freshman year of college, which makes me feel very old. They forced you to dorm with a bunch of strangers that first semester, you know, just so you would get to know other people and make new friends. What a disaster that was. You know, all these guys did was smoke weed, which is fine. I have nothing against that. I know many people listening to this right now, they may be doing that very thing as they listen to this podcast. So I have no problem with that, except that I would come back from class and my room was filled with smoke every single day. The first time I walked in, I thought there was a fire. I couldn't even see the bodies through the fog of smoke every day. And my roommate would have like five of his friends who I didn't even know. I never saw these people before. If they were even his friends, who the hell knows who they were, sitting in the room, just smoking. I mean, these were tiny rooms. Some of them would be sitting on my bed. Now, I don't care what you do on your own time, in your own room, that's your business. But the way I look at it, now you've invaded my personal space, okay? And that I don't go for. So I'd kick them all out, and to this day, I hate the smell of marijuana smoke because of that. They'd do the deal where they would stuff the towel under the door, and then they would say, oh, yeah, we're doing it for you. It's like, no, you're not. You're doing it to keep the smoke out of the hallway so you don't get caught, you dumb shits. And I told my roommate one day, I said, you know, he was this kid from Connecticut. The way he would talk to his mom on the phone every day, they would fight. He'd call her a cunt and hang up on her. I mean, a real piece of shit this kid was. I think she kind of knew he had a drug problem, but was in denial over it. I knew he was selling drugs, and I told him one day, I said, I don't want that shit here, because if you get caught, we're all gone, right? We're all out of here. Everybody in the suite, because what it was our room, and it was another room in one suite. We had like a shared common area right outside our rooms and a bathroom that we shared. But all four of us would be expelled, right? They had just kicked four other kids out of our building over something similar. I mean, they were real strict about this. So I warned him, and of course, he basically told me to go fuck myself, which made for a wonderful living situation over the next 2 months. So I went and I put my name on a waiting list for a single room for a different dorm. And I didn't expect anything out of it because there's a waiting list. There's a waiting list probably as long as my two arms put together, and I'm a freshman. You know, you go to the bottom of the list when you're a freshman. Well, over the winter break, I got the call. I was like a fucking developmental guy getting called up to the main roster. I got the call, and they said, we have a room open. You have to come down by like 5 o'clock today and take a look at it, or we're going to give it to somebody else. So I, you know, rushed down there, took a look at the room. I didn't really need to do that because I knew I was going to take it anyway, so of course I accepted it. The room wasn't any bigger than a walk-in closet, but, you know, again, I didn't care, so I took it. Now, my roommate was away at the time because it was winter break. So I remember I got a buddy of mine to help me move all my shit out of the room, and I took the fridge. There was a fridge in the common area that he and I shared that we had both paid for. So I took the fridge too, you know, because, you know, fuck me, no, fuck you. I took the fridge. And so, long story short, 2 weeks later, I'm in my room, and I get a phone call, and it's the kid's mother. I don't even know how she got my number, but she did. And she is going nuts on the phone. How can you do that? You can't just move out like that in the fridge. You took the fridge. And so I'm very respectful. I say, well, you know, your son got more use out of this thing than I did, which he did. You know, he and his buddies. So the way I look at it, it was his the first half of the year. And now the second half, it's mine. And yeah, she's still screaming. I said, I'm sorry, I'm literally about to walk out the door to my next class. I gotta go. And, oh, by the way, I just thought you might want to know, your son is a drug dealer. And right before I hung up, I'm pretty sure I could hear her head explode. But I hung up on her, so I can't be sure. I can't tell you the feeling of satisfaction that I had when I walked out of that room. It is still to this day one of my proudest moments. So that's my personal story about what was going on at that time. Some other things that were happening in October of 2000 when the Mets last went to the World Series. We had George W. Bush and Al Gore fighting over the presidency in an election that I don't think it's an exaggeration to say changed the history of the world, not just this country. Curb Your Enthusiasm. I wasn't even aware of this until I looked it up. Debuted on HBO. I didn't think it was that early, but apparently it was. And Curb Your Enthusiasm, fantastic show. I'm still hoping we get another season. And lastly here, the Jets beat the Dolphins in the Monday Night Miracle in October of 2000, which these days we refer to as a good episode of Raw. So as far as what was going on in WWE, when the Mets last won the World Series, when they went to the World Series, I want to get ahead of myself here. Game one that year was on October 21st. The next night, WWE had its No Mercy pay-per-view. And I've said it before, I'm not the only one. I think the consensus is that WWF in the year 2000 was probably its best year ever creatively. You know, the storylines, the characters, it was mostly all great. Okay, ratings were still high, not as high as the year before, but this was a year where Steve Austin was on the shelf for most of it. He didn't come back until September. Now, he was their biggest star, so you would expect there would be some kind of a drop, and there was, but it wasn't a humongous drop. Chris Kresge was the guy responsible. I wrote his name down here because I know for a fact I've talked about Kresge on this podcast before. He was the one who was responsible for much of what we saw on WWF television that year. He was their head writer after Vince Russo bailed on them. I've talked about Kresge. Like I said, he died from cancer many years ago. He's very young. But what he would do is he would use storyboards to map out a lot of the big storylines that he would come up with. And, you know, he would get laughed at for it, but it's not a coincidence that people look at that as their best year creatively. And it was right around this time that he was relieved of his duties as the head writer, it's a polite way of putting it, and he was replaced by Stephanie McMahon. I believe this No Mercy show may have been the last pay-per-view of the Kresge era before Stephanie took over, because I think it was maybe the next month. It was right around that time that Stephanie took over. On that show, Kurt Angle pinned The Rock to win his first WWE title, despite Triple H's best efforts. You've heard the story, I'm sure. Kurt Angle has told it before. Triple H, you know, sitting in on one of the production meetings, and it wasn't enough for Triple H to, you know, have some say and some input on his own storylines, but he had to butt his nose in other people's business as well. And he piped up and said, you know, he thought Kurt Angle was too small to be the world champion. This is when they were talking about putting the belt on him for the first time. And, oh, he's too small. And Gerald Briscoe's in the meeting, and he pipes up, and he says, well, why don't the two of you have a shoot fight to see how much size really matters? And Triple H got real quiet after that. Yeah, Triple H had already killed off that great love triangle storyline that they were doing with himself and Kurt Angle and Stephanie McMahon. They had that one match on the pay-per-view right before this one, singles match, and Triple H just beat him, and that was it. That was the end of it. I mean, talk about ending something, you know, prematurely. They had a good thing going there, and it just was so sudden, it just came to an end. You know, and I had always read, and this I don't know for sure, but I had always been of the belief that the plan was to have Stephanie turn on Triple H and end up going with Kurt Angle. And Triple H isn't stupid. I mean, he probably knew what would end up happening here if this storyline went on very much longer. So in a way, I guess I can't blame him if he had anything to do with this ending so abruptly. But that was one of the better storylines they did in 2000. Triple H actually had a hell of a match with Chris Benoit here on this No Mercy pay-per-view. That month, October 2000, also gave us the Rikishi heel turn that I'm sure everybody remembers. He did it for The Rock, right? Famous words, infamous words. Not one of the best storylines they've ever done. I'm not going to sugarcoat it and make it sound like every single thing they did that year and every single thing back in the Attitude Era was so great, because it wasn't. This storyline, and as far as what they were trying to do, they were trying to elevate Rikishi to that next level, and it just didn't work. It just didn't work. He wrestled Austin on that No Mercy show. That was Austin's first official match back from neck surgery. Wasn't even really a match. It was more of a street fight. Austin just, you know, beat his ass all over the place. Mick Foley was WWF commissioner at that time. One of the more entertaining things about Raw in 2000, I thought, was Foley as the commissioner and Foley's interactions with Edge and Christian, when Edge and Christian were first really making a name for themselves. Eddie Guerrero and Chyna were in an on-screen relationship at the time. She was his mamacita. You know, when I think back to stuff like that, I just miss Eddie Guerrero that much more. But to show you that it wasn't all good during this period, we also had on the show William Regal defending the European title against Naked Midian. And no matter how bad Raw may get these days, I don't care. It's still better than Naked Midian. So that's what was going on. October of 2000. Quick history lesson there. Let's talk about tonight. Hell in a Cell from Los Angeles, California. We'll run down the card here from... let's start from the bottom. We'll start from the bottom and work our way up to the main event. The kickoff match originally was supposed to be Randy Orton and Dean Ambrose against Luke Harper and Braun Strowman. And that changed because Randy Orton is hurt. He is out with an injury. According to the latest Observer newsletter, he was taking out the trash last week and suffered a dislocated shoulder. Took 3 hours to pop the shoulder back into place. You know, I read that and I just thought to myself, is he dumping a body? I mean, what is this? Is this guy mafioso in his spare time? How dislocating your shoulder, taking out the garbage. That's a new one. I guess it's possible. I don't know what kind of garbage he was taking out. That's why my first thought was a fucking body. Taking a body to the curb. I don't know. That's kind of odd. And he's had issues like shoulder, clavicle issues. He's broken his collarbone twice, I think. But he's been okay for a number of years. So I don't know how long he's going to be out for. I don't know if he needs surgery. I don't know if he knows yet if he's going to need surgery. He may only be out a few weeks. If he needs surgery, it'd probably be a lot longer. So anyway, the match is off. The new kickoff match is Neville, Cesaro, and Dolph Ziggler against Sheamus, King Barrett, and Rusev. It almost doesn't even matter who wins this match. I kind of feel like we've seen this match a couple of times already, and every time, like, Neville is the one who takes the fall. The babyfaces have to get a bone thrown to them at some point, so I'm going to go with them. My pick is Neville, Cesaro, and Dolph Ziggler. And Neville really is the one who should get the fall there because he needs it more than the others do. Cesaro, you know, what can I say? It almost just doesn't even matter at this point. Kevin Owens and Ryback for the Intercontinental title. It would be idiotic to take the title off Kevin Owens. I don't think they will. Kevin Owens is my pick. I still say, you know, keep it on him. Keep it on him until January. Sami Zayn comes back, dumps him out of the Rumble. The story writes itself. Dudley Boys against the New Day for the tag team titles. I'm going to go with the Dudley Boys here. Same situation as I talked about with the kickoff guys a few minutes ago, where it just seems like the heels, they win, they win, they win. We've seen the same finish now a couple of times, including at that Madison Square Garden show where you just have Xavier run in for the cheap DQ. You can only do that so many times. It's not like the New Day is going to beat the Dudley Boys clean. I don't see that happening. And so to do another cheap DQ-type finish would be complete bullshit. So I think they're at a point now where they don't have a choice. They got to put these belts on the Dudley Boys, or the Dudley Boys are going to be dead in the water. So I'm going to pick them, and Dudley Boys win their, what would that be, their 20th tag team title? I don't even know. I've lost track. Charlotte and Nikki Bella for the Divas Championship. To put the title back on Nikki Bella would be just the death of whatever this Divas movement is that they're trying to, you know, peddle to us on TV every week. I mean, it's already kind of dead, but to put the title back on Nikki Bella would be the mother of all mistakes. So Charlotte is going to retain the championship just because I refuse to believe these people are that stupid. I know they're stupid, but they're not that stupid. At least I hope not. John Cena is having a U.S. title open challenge on this show with a mystery opponent. They have not announced anybody has accepted his challenge yet, so he'll come out, he'll stand there, and the mystery person will come out. Now, this is probably it for Cena until the end of December. He's going away. Whatever he's doing, supposedly filming a TV show, whatever it is, he's going to be away for about 2 months. Do they have to take the U.S. title off him? No, they don't have to. They could keep the belt on him, but I think they are going to take it off him. It's just a matter of who's going to end up with it. Honestly, now that that kickoff match was canceled with Orton and Ambrose against Harper and Strowman, Dean Ambrose has no match on the show. Dean Ambrose is a guy that they really need to do something with. I know they're putting everything behind Roman Reigns. Roman Reigns is still their boy. But you've got Randy Orton out. You got John Cena, who's going to be out for a while. Even if they don't want to, even if they're forced into it because of these circumstances, hopefully they're in a situation now where they realize, hey, we got to fucking push this guy. And that's why I would like to see Dean Ambrose come out, accept the challenge. He has no match on the show anyway. And actually beat John Cena. It's not a match that we've never seen before. As a matter of fact, I think Ambrose may have been one of the first people to accept the open challenge when he started this whole gimmick many months ago. maybe the first person actually on Raw, but he's got to beat Cena. He's got to beat him. He's got to beat him clean, win the title, and then they have to actually put the same effort behind Ambrose as U.S. champion as they've been doing with John Cena. You know, Ambrose cannot afford to go back to being the U.S. champ he was, you know, 2 years ago, who never defends the belt, which was a joke. Even he would joke about it. Ah, it's too much paperwork, you know, whatever. Remember that line? So I think people who are looking for Daniel Bryan and they're looking for a big name, look, I mean, could it be Bryan? Could the fix be in and he's already cleared and we don't know it yet? Yeah, anything's possible. And it'd be a hell of an idea. I just don't think that's going to happen. I'm looking at this realistically and I'm saying you don't have to go and bring back an old guy. Okay, you could do the Bryan thing, but don't go back and bring in fucking, I don't know, Carlito or some other person. Just go with what you have, right? Make them stronger. Make Dean Ambrose stronger. And beating John Cena would be a hell of a way to start that off. So I'm going to predict it's Dean Ambrose and he beats Cena and becomes a new U.S. champion. Roman Reigns and Bray Wyatt in a Hell in a Cell match. This you know, could go either way. It depends how much longer they want to go on with this feud. They made it sound like this is it. And this should be it. This is Hell in a Cell. Hell in a Cell should be the climax of this feud, not another stone along the way here. I don't know what their plans are going forward for these guys over the next couple of months. I'm going to assume this is not the end, just because this is WWE. It's never over, right? It's never the end. We'll see the same matches over and over and over and over again. They'll probably have a fucking rematch on Raw this Monday. As far as who wins, I'm going to go with Bray Wyatt. I think Roman Reigns, I guess it just depends on what they do here. It's not like I see Ambrose coming out and turning on him or anything like that. Although I think the Wyatts will get involved, or try to get involved anyway. I don't know. I just have this feeling that Bray's taking the win here. And you could argue that he needs it more than Roman does. Roman's going to be protected no matter what. I think Bray Wyatt needs a big win, probably more than Roman Reigns does, and I think he gets it. We have Seth Rollins and Kane, or more specifically, Demon Kane, for the WWE Championship. Corporate Kane is fired if Kane fails to lose the championship here. This month marks the 18-year anniversary of Kane's debut in WWE as that character. It's also the 18-year anniversary that same night of the very first Hell in a Cell match between Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. Is there a chance that because of this, if they mention this on commentary, and they may not, is there a chance that they could give Kane this token title win and then just take the belt off him the next night or at the next pay-per-view? Of course there's a chance, right? There's always a chance. But I think in this case, it's a fat chance. I do not see Kane winning the championship, and that would just be a completely ludicrous idea. And I'm not a Kane hater, right? In small doses, I actually like Kane. Kane is not worn on me as much as the Big Show has. But that doesn't mean I want to see him with the championship, okay? It just, you cannot put the title on Kane. I'm sorry, you just can't. You've got a product right now where the ratings are getting lower and lower and lower and lower, and even if, let's say, you have a good week where they don't go down, they just kind of stay where they are, the numbers aren't good compared to what the norm was even 6 months ago, right? It's obvious that people are tuning out, whatever the reason is. The answer is not putting the fucking title on Kane. Rollins has not been lighting the world on fire as champion. You want to take the title off him and put it on somebody else? Fine. Kane is not that person. So I'm going to go with Seth Rollins, which makes me kind of sad because, you know, I kind of get a kick out of corporate Kane sometimes in those backstage skits. And the stipulation is that if Kane loses, then corporate Kane goes away, which means we're left with the demon. But wouldn't be the first time they didn't adhere to one of their own stipulations if they just back out on it. So I don't know how they're going to go about doing it, but I'm going to say that Seth Rollins leaves with the championship, and that leaves us with the main event. Brock Lesnar and The Undertaker, Hell in a Cell match. This is it. That's what they said, right? The climax, the finale. No more matches ever between these two ever again. Brock Lesnar has to win this match. That's it. Period. End of story. There is no other outcome here. There's nothing. Brock Lesnar wins. Period. That's it. There is no other outcome that you can go with here that makes any sense. Undertaker is not retiring. He'll still be around for WrestleMania and whatever else. But Brock Lesnar is going to be around more often. And Brock Lesnar is the real attraction here. He's more of an attraction than The Undertaker is at this point. And Brock lost at SummerSlam. You cannot have Brock Lesnar lose back-to-back matches. He lost at SummerSlam on you know, kind of a bullshit call there. So there was some controversy. So it was almost okay for him to lose. In Hell in a Cell, he shouldn't be losing clean to The Undertaker. And I don't think this match is going to be as good as their match from 02. It's not going to be a bloodbath, and these guys are 13 years older. But I still think they'll go out there and have a pretty good match. I think they'll surprise some people. But I think Brock Lesnar should win. I think Brock Lesnar does win. I think this is the end of the feud. They both probably go away. I doubt we even see either of them for the rest of the year until maybe Royal Rumble. And that's your card for Hell in a Cell. And so, again, as far as the Lesnar-Undertaker match, is there going to be a big swerve or a big twist? I don't know what it would be. Unless it has something to do with their opponent, one of their opponents for WrestleMania, who that would be, I don't have any idea. It's obviously not going to be Steve Austin. That pretty much was laid to rest, I think, this past week. So I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do, but I know that Brock Lesnar's winning this match. And if he's not, they're out of their fucking mind. Raw this past Monday was live from Dallas, Texas, the site of next year's WrestleMania. And it's hard for me to hate on any Raw show that opens with the glass shattering. Stone Cold Steve Austin making his first appearance on Raw in 4 years. He's been smart enough to stay away. Unfortunately, his entrance was the best part because 5 minutes later he introduced The Undertaker and then vanished into thin air like Cesaro's push, never to be seen again. They had Austin, they had Undertaker, they had Shawn Michaels, they had Ric Flair. And still, they only pulled a 2.2 rating. That's like I said, they're just putting a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound, and even the Band-Aid now is not getting it done. They're bleeding through the Band-Aid. They need to address the root cause of all of this, and trotting guys out there like Austin, who we don't get to see very often, it's cool, but it's not the answer. We had no corporate Kane on this show. They announced that he was suspended for the night by the authority. No Demon Kane either, which was odd, given that he's the one challenging for the title on the pay-per-view. But hey, I'm not complaining. Undertaker and Brock Lesnar were both on this show. Again, they blew them off very early on. I don't know if it was something with the football game, maybe it was before the game started, I don't know. But Austin, Undertaker, Lesnar, it's like they front-loaded the show with them, and they were never seen again. Right? I don't think they were seen again. I know Austin wasn't. I thought the final build to the Lesnar-Undertaker match was very disappointing. They did nothing at all to get me any more interested than I already was in seeing them wrestle again, which is only slight. Undertaker, you know, the Texas dick kicker was cheered because they were in Texas and Lesnar was booed. You know, you people cheer a man who kicks other men in the dick. What's wrong with you? They announced Orton was not there. He was also missing from their recent tour of Mexico, we were told, kind of playing it off like maybe the Wyatt family had kidnapped him or something. Ambrose said he didn't care. He challenged Harper and Strowman to a fight later in the show. Shawn Michaels came out. He ate part of a kid's pizza on his way to the ring and then choked on it for the remainder of the segment. You know, that's what he gets for eating somebody else's food. The prick. Seth Rollins came out, went face-to-face with Shawn Michaels, got a lot of people wet, I'm sure, over the idea of doing Rollins and HBK at WrestleMania, which they're not. He said some people have referred to him as the new Shawn Michaels, and Shawn said if he had a nickel for every time he heard some new guy was the next HBK, he'd be a billionaire. I thought Shawn was really good here. I don't get the sense, you know, usually from him, I don't get the sense that he cares a whole hell of a lot about wrestling anymore. Not just actually wrestling, just watching it or paying attention to what's going on. He doesn't really pay attention to it. He has no interest in having another match. He wants to just be with his family and go hunting and do his TV show. He has no reason to really be motivated when he does go out there for segments like this. And yet when he does, he just makes it look like a piece of cake. He makes it look effortless. Yeah, he probably cut the best promo on the entire show. So Michaels and Rollins would be one hell of a WrestleMania match, by the way. Just the idea of it. I'm not saying it wouldn't be. It'd be a fucking fantastic match, especially in Texas. It's too bad, though, we'll never get to see it because it ain't happening. Michaels brought out Ryback as Seth's opponent, and believe it or not, hold on to your socks here. You're not going to believe this, but Rollins not only won a match, he did so relatively clean in the middle of the ring with the pedigree. I can't remember the last time I saw this guy win with his move on TV. You have a better chance of seeing Haley's Comet or Vince McMahon actually taking the time to respond to one of Vince Russo's emails than you do seeing Seth Rollins get a clean win on television. But we got one here. They trotted Ric Flair out to the ring. He didn't even get an entrance. Ric Flair got a jobber entrance on this show, which I thought was hilarious. He introduced Roman Reigns as Dean Ambrose's tag team partner against Luke Harper and Braun Strowman tonight. I didn't even know they were doing a tag team match, but apparently they are, or were. Reigns came to the ring, and the Wyatts magically appeared in the aisleway. Luke Harper was not there. As it turns out, it has nothing to do with the photo that Jericho leaked online of all the wrestlers posing and wearing the Harper t-shirts. He didn't get any heat for it. It was personal. Whatever it was personal. He is supposed to be on the pay-per-view tonight, so all is well with Luke Harper. And so he wasn't here. What they decided to do was simply plug Eric Rowan into Harper's spot with absolutely no angle, no explanation whatsoever. Quite possibly the most anticlimactic return in the history of WWE. Rowan literally just showed up, standing beside Bray Wyatt and Braun Strowman. He had the old sheet mask on. You could tell it was him. He's got the big orange beard. It's not like, hey, who's under the mask? It's pretty fucking obvious who's under the mask. It was just like he never left. And meanwhile, he's been gone for what now? 5 months? 4 months? Something like that? I would say the second most anticlimactic return is probably still Todd Grisham's very enthusiastic call on Christian's return to WWE back on the ECW show. Remember that whole thing? It's Christian. I think I actually just put more enthusiasm into that than Todd did. Roman pulled up a chair, sat face-to-face with Bray. I thought it was kind of an interesting way to go about doing this, even though these two guys supposedly hate each other's guts, and it's personal, and it's real life, and yet they're sitting in folding chairs face-to-face. But I thought it was kind of unique. And Roman's cutting a promo on him before they finally started brawling. Ambrose ran out to even the odds, and that was the whole segment. Backstage, Rollins was meeting with Triple H and Stephanie when in walked Shawn Michaels. He started stirring up shit by suggesting that Rollins tag up with Reigns and Ambrose against the Wyatt family tonight. But then again, he already wrestled one match, and Shawn said he probably couldn't handle another one. And so his reverse psychology worked, because Seth Rollins is a moron, and he said, I will team with Roman Reigns and Dean Ambrose tonight. And so as many of you so astutely pointed out, I got tweet after tweet about this. How ironic that the day after I do a whole 20-minute review of the Shield vs. Wyatt's match from Elimination Chamber last year as part of my top 8 countdown, and I rant about how they ended the damn thing so early, lo and behold, we have ourselves a little Shield reunion on Raw and a Shield vs. Wyatt family main event. So needless to say, I was very happy to see the Shield reunited, if only for one night, even though it's dumb to not build it up first. Literally just came out of nowhere. But I'll take it. I'll take it. Because who the hell knows when the next time is we're going to see these three guys together. They will reunite. I guarantee you there will be a Shield reunion. But it may not be for another year. It could be 2 years. It could be 3 years. Who knows? Kevin Owens beat Mark Henry with a pop-up powerbomb. I'll say that again. He beat Mark Henry with a pop-up powerbomb. This was very impressive. And the main event was the Shield against the Wyatt family. This was not the Shield versus Wyatt family of old. Rollins does not like Ambrose and Reigns. They do not like Rollins. We didn't get Rollins fully invested. He ended up bailing on his team later in the match. So it wasn't quite the same thing. But it was still fun to see these two teams back in the ring. And just like that match at Elimination Chamber, when I reviewed it and I mentioned before the match even started, before they even touched, before the bell even rang, you had people chanting, this is awesome. They were doing the same thing here. This is awesome chants before the match even got going. Match ended when Braun Strowman had his little head and neck choke on Roman Reigns, and Dean Ambrose whacked Strowman with a kendo stick for the DQ. And Strowman and Ambrose were brawling outside the ring. Everybody ended up outside the ring, and Roman Reigns did a crazy suicidal dive. Really nice dive, but took his life into his own hands. Out over the top rope, landed, wiped everybody out. Hopefully Roman Reigns never pulls that kind of stuff in a match with The Miz, because if he ever does, he's going to end up in a bad way. Miz has a, a little bit of a reputation when it comes to catching or not catching people. But they caught him. It was fine. It was a cool moment. A little bit of a botch in the end. I don't think Roman was supposed to spear Bray Wyatt. I think the idea was that Rowan would kind of save Bray and dive in harm's way and get the spear, but he just mistimed it. So he ended up spearing Rowan anyway. And that's how the show went off the air. I flipped over to the Stone Cold podcast with Brock Lesnar, which if you haven't seen it, I think it's worth watching. I didn't learn a lot of new stuff watching it, but it's just fun to watch Brock in that kind of environment. It was very distracting looking at his sweat mustache throughout the entire interview. But of course, Austin, I mean, who's going to tell Brock Lesnar, hey, dude, you got a fucking sweat mustache here, right? Nobody was going to say a word to him about it. There was one point where they were talking about hunting, their love of hunting, and the kind of guns that they own and the ammo that they use. And Brock just had this, he was talking about this one particular kind of gun, and he just goes, I love the gun. And I said, more terrifying words have never been spoken than Brock Lesnar talking about how much he loves his gun. As if this fucking guy needs a gun to be any more intimidating. He showed some love at one point. It was very sad to Big Boss Man and Mr. Perfect, who of course are both dead. But he talked about how nice they were to him and how just helpful in terms of teaching him certain things and being like mentors to him. Austin asked him, hey, how come you don't talk a lot? They talked about the UFC, and he said, I saw some of those promos that you were cutting at the UFC, like press conferences and stuff. You were really good. How come you don't really talk much anymore? And Brock was honest. He goes, honestly, Steve, I suck at it. And then he had the line of the night. Brock just goes, I've got to feed the Jew. He's got to eat too. I've got to feed the Jew. I want to see that sign tonight, tomorrow night, and at all the events going forward. I want to see Brock Lesnar, I've got to feed the Jew sign. That could be a t-shirt right there. Brock said Suplex City in a match, and he made millions off of it. They can do the same thing with Feed the Jew. As long as you don't feed him pork, everything will be okay. And they also talked about the botched Shooting Star Press at WrestleMania 19. I'm kind of surprised they brought it up. They even showed footage of it as they were talking about it. Brock missing the mark, almost breaking his neck. It was not entirely his fault. Kurt Angle was just way too far. I remember watching it and thinking, man, he's far away. Kurt is very far. So either Kurt needs to move his ass over, which we've seen guys do a million times, and yes, it looks fake, but at the end of the day, you're trying to protect the other person. Maybe Kurt just, you know, had his eyes closed. Maybe he just couldn't judge. Maybe Brock should have climbed back down and moved him over. I guess that would have, you know, been weird for him to do that. But he landed on his head. He probably got a concussion. Thankfully, nothing more. He's got such strong neck muscles. I'm sure that helps save him. Although I recall him and Kurt were both really fucked up backstage when that show was over. Brock probably was concussed. He was angry. He was just in a very foul mood. And Kurt, who should never have even wrestled that match and ended up, you know, he needed neck surgery. I remember reading that he was like sitting in the locker room maybe or standing. He was naked and in shock. He like went into shock. Like, it's like everybody was fucked up. Austin was fucked up. Kurt was fucked up. Brock was fucked up. There was a high casualty rate coming out of WrestleMania that year. You could throw Booker T on that list too, although for different reasons. So they talk about this, and Brock said, listen, somebody talked me into doing that. I did not want to do it. And he was reluctant. He said, I'm not going to name any names, because I think the person still works there, or something like that. Maybe he didn't say the person still works there, but he wasn't going to name any names. And at first I thought it was Jim Ross, because I seem to vaguely recall that maybe in an interview somewhere he had once named Jim Ross as the person who kind of gave him the advice, like, get your WrestleMania moment, you should save it for WrestleMania and do it there. And I was wrong. I got JR confused with John Laurinaitis. Somebody pointed that out to me when I had reviewed Brock Lesnar's book, which I did. I reviewed Death Clutch on this podcast a long time ago. And again, cheap plug. If you want to get Brock's book, you can use our Audible link right now. Go get it. But no, seriously, you should absolutely use our link to get it, because it's actually a good book. But in the book, I had forgotten it was actually Laurinaitis as the one who encouraged him to do the move. And so it's not a big secret. Now you know the answer. At least according to Brock Lesnar, it was Johnny Ace we can blame for Brock Lesnar nearly killing himself at WrestleMania. And by the way, if you want to go back and listen to my review, that I did of Brock Lesnar's book. I had to go look it up. I couldn't remember which episode number it was, but I looked it up. It's episode 215 of The Sound Off, if you never heard it before, or if you don't remember it and you want to go back and listen. That is the episode number to go look up in the archives.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
Tyler Breeze debuted on SmackDown this week with Summer Rae. It was during a Miz TV segment. Summer was there. Dolph Ziggler was there. And they're now going to be paired off, I guess, as Summer Breeze. A rare week where if it happened on SmackDown, it actually did happen. And so my apologies to UpRocks. They were right. Tyler Breeze has, in fact, finally made his way to the main roster after 5 long years in developmental. I'm disappointed because I wanted him to win that NXT title one time before he got the call-up. But I'm happy for the guy. You know, he's been waiting for this for a long, long time. I hope he knocks it out of the park. There are positives to this. I'm trying to stay positive here because I'm a big Tyler Breeze fan. I want to see him do well. And you know my thoughts on them calling guys up from NXT to the main roster because why shouldn't I be cynical, right? Give me a real good reason why I shouldn't be cynical. But I'm trying to be positive about this. And yes, it happened on SmackDown, which is a dead zone until they move to USA in January. Okay, but there's two things. One, his first opponent is going to be Dolph Ziggler, which all but guarantees, unless they have just awful chemistry together, that right out of the gate, he's going to have the chance to have some really fantastic matches and hopefully impress a lot of people. And second, and this goes to all the people negative about him debuting on SmackDown and not on Raw, from what I understand, from what I've read before, Triple H takes a lot more hands-on approach with SmackDown. I don't know so much about the scripting of the show and all that, but the producing, you know, Vince is there, but it's more Triple H's show. At least that's, again, what I've read before. And there is likely no greater advocate for Tyler Breeze than Triple H. Triple H wants to see this guy succeed. He's seen what he's capable of on NXT. And as one of Triple H's guys, right, as one of Triple H's boys, it's in Triple H's best interest to see this guy succeed and get over. It's in his best interest because otherwise it reflects poorly on Triple H because there are all these guys that he's building around for months and months and months on that NXT brand, and you don't want to bring him up and then watch him flop. So maybe it's a good thing if this happened on SmackDown on a show where Triple H has a little more control over things. And also depends if we end up seeing more of Tyler Breeze on Thursdays than we do on Mondays. Some guys do tend to get more airtime on one show over the other. I almost think that might be better off for the guy. You know, get him on the main roster, right? So you got the big call-up, but keep him the hell away from Monday Night Raw. Maybe that's the best formula for him. The only problem is I don't watch SmackDown, so if he's off NXT completely and the only way I could see him is on SmackDown, I just have to fish around online and find his segments every week. But I'm pulling for him, I really am, and there's no better opponent for him right out of the gate than Dolph Ziggler. And I hope that they have a match, and they have a series of matches, and they just steal the show and tear the house down, and hopefully that doesn't rub people the wrong way, because sometimes wrestling can be funny like that. But everybody wants to go out and steal the show, right? So hopefully they do that. NXT this week, Asuka opened the show against Billie Kay. There was a sweet rolling armbar here by Asuka. I love that move. She won with the Asuka Lock, which is a crossface chicken wing into the body scissors for the submission. Asuka's just, she's so much fun to watch. You know, this is only her, what, third match maybe on NXT, and she's just so much fun to watch. I'm still hoping we get an Asuka-Bailey match after the Alexa feud runs its course, before Bailey ultimately gets the call down to the main roster. I just think that would be a hell of a match. Kaz and Enzo took on the Mechanics, Dash and Dawson. They were beating Enzo down and just destroying this guy's knee. And one of the Mechanics went and knocked Big Kaz off the apron. And I think it was Dawson, when he turned around, he got rolled up by Enzo Amore for the pin. So the pin was just a total afterthought. Almost immediately, as the referee hit three, Wilder came in, he attacked Enzo, they ganged up on him, Big Kaz came in, they beat him down as well, laid him out with their little flapjack into a codebreaker move. And Kaz and Enzo, I think they may have passed their peak in NXT. Not that they're not still popular, but you know, sometimes when an opportunity presents itself and you don't take it, you don't always get it back. I still feel now more than ever, I felt this way a few months ago, and I feel the same way today, that putting those tag team titles on them at TakeOver in Brooklyn was the right move to make, and they didn't do it. At the very least, debut them on Raw in Brooklyn the next night. You know, they would have blown the roof off the place. Talk about a first impression. You're in Brooklyn. You're in New York. You're in the tri-state area. These guys, I think, are at the point where they're ready to be called up, right? They're every bit as ready as some of the other people they've called up. And they didn't do it. I think their act will get over well on the main roster once they make it. But, you know, ever since then, it just feels like they've really cooled off a lot. And maybe it's just because we haven't seen a lot of them. But they feel like, they don't feel like a hot act the way they did a few months ago. And I think they made a mistake by not doing that. Eva Marie sent in another video from overseas. Hopefully she stays there. We then got the NXT debut of independent sensation James Storm. This was hilarious. They actually acknowledged the fact that James Storm spent time in WCW, which he did, which I had completely forgotten about. He was an enhancement guy. They mentioned his time in WCW, but not in TNA. They said he spent the last 15 years working on the independent scene. That is just savage, I think is the right word to use. Now, to be fair, many independent promotions do pay more and do draw bigger crowds than TNA does today. So it's not necessarily a knock against James Storm to say that, hey, this guy's been, you know, playing the independent scene for the last 15 years. Look, it's not as though they consider TNA any sort of a real threat anymore. I almost think like they consider TNA more of an annoyance at this point. You know, maybe there's some guys they're interested in, but they can't go after them because they're under contract. I think they have so little respect for TNA and for Dixie Carter that they just simply refuse to acknowledge their existence. I was shocked that they allowed Sting to slip in a TNA mention on his new DVD. They have so little respect for them, they'll mention Ring of Honor, they'll mention Evolve, they'll mention New Japan Pro Wrestling, but they will not acknowledge TNA. You know, maybe they're afraid their PG audience might think it really does stand for tits and ass. You know, can't have them Googling TNA. You know, they might end up with one of those China videos. I don't know, but it's just amazing to me how little respect, it's almost comical, how little respect they have for TNA. Storm wrestled Danny Burch. Burch got more offense in than I thought he would, but James Storm got a quick comeback, won with his 8-second ride move, which he sets up like Sheamus' white noise and then spins the guy around into like a bulldog. I'm describing it very poorly. The move sucks. He should just use his Eye of the Storm or his super kick. He told Danny Burch after the match, "Sorry about your damn luck." So he's still using that catchphrase. Still nothing new on whether or not he's actually signed a deal with them. I'd be stunned. I would be stunned if he went back to TNA. I don't see how he cannot sign a deal with WWE. You know, he got the foot in the door thanks to Billy Gunn. He said he was friends with Billy Gunn. Billy Gunn got him a look. You know, he's part of what is really the hottest brand, or at least it feels like it's got the most buzz around it right now. And it's not like he doesn't know anybody down there. He's friends with a lot of people who are down there. Samoa Joe is down there. And this is it. I mean, he's 38 years old. If he passes this up, let alone passes this up to go back to TNA, he's done. That's it. It's like I said before, sometimes you get an opportunity, you got to take advantage of it because it may not be there the next time. So I would be beyond stunned if he ends up going back to TNA. I think there's not a 0% chance of it happening, but I think there's a very slim chance that that happens. Unless they absolutely blow him away with like a multi-million dollar offer, which they're not going to do. I just don't see that happening, but there's no update yet. Supposedly they wanted him to be at the next set of tapings. Well, they had the next set of tapings this past week, and, you know, I didn't look at the spoilers, but I know he wasn't there. So what that means, I don't know. Next week, it is Samoa Joe against SmackDown's own Tyler Breeze. They also announced Finn Balor will defend the NXT Championship against Apollo Crews in 2 weeks. We got a really great video package on Apollo Crews talking about his upbringing, his mother. He got really emotional talking about his mom and how hard she had to work to give her kids what they wanted. And they had footage of him wrestling in Evolve. You can't watch this and not want to see this guy succeed. You know, one of the fundamental differences between NXT and the main roster is that they make the effort on this show to get you to know about the characters, to care about the characters. On Raw, you don't see profiles like this very often. Every now and then, they'll have those great vignettes they do on like Brock Lesnar or something. And there's a reason people react to Brock like he's a big deal. I mean, there's 15 different reasons why. That's just a small part of it. But they don't treat anybody else like anything special, and very rarely do they give us a reason to care about them. It's just a bunch of random six-man tags every week with six bodies out there. You know, with 3 hours of television, there's really no excuse for them to not have stuff like this on that show. Baron Corbin and Rhino was our main event, stemming from Corbin eliminating Rhino from the Battle Royal the week before. I thought this match was boring, just boring as all hell. A real step back from what I've seen lately from Baron Corbin. 75% of the match was just punch, kick, punch, kick, punch, kick. You know, Rhino hit a gore on Corbin, but he's clearly been studying his John Cena tapes, and he kicked out at 2. Rhino set up for another spear, but when he went for it, Corbin caught him for the End of Days, and he pinned him, so he got the win. Show ended with a pre-taped Samoa Joe promo backstage, and he was looking directly into the camera, right into Tyler Breeze's soul. And it was great. Joe told him to take a selfie, doll himself up real nice, because after he gets done with him next week, he'll never look the same again. So, a good show. Not a great show. A boring main event, but overall, I thought it was a good effort. And again, that Apollo Crews video package, you gotta go out of your way to see it. They probably have it up on their YouTube channel if you don't want to fast forward through the episode on the network. A couple of TNA notes here, and then we'll move on. TNA finally announced their big India tour this week, which is shorter than what it had originally been rumored to be. The dates were rumored to be the end of November through the 5th of December. They announced December 2nd, 3rd, and 4th is going to be their tour. And they brought in, for the announcement, they brought in the great Khali. And boy, did he look so happy to be there in those pictures I saw of him with all the TNA people. He looked just delighted, overjoyed to be there. He won't be wrestling, I don't think. At least I hope not. But they're also doing a talent search in conjunction with the tour for the next Indian star, and Khali is going to be part of the selection process. He'll also help mentor the winner. You know what? Now that I think about this, they're going to be in India. I don't know how big of a deal Khali still is over there. But now that I think about it, he's totally wrestling on one of those shows. I would actually be very surprised if he doesn't, if they don't actually bring him in to do a match or an angle or something on an episode of Impact. Also wanted to mention that Bram had all the domestic abuse charges against him dropped from that case a couple of months ago. They decided against pressing charges, and as such, he has now been reinstated to the active TNA roster. This does not mean he didn't choke his girlfriend. This was not the first time that he's been accused of domestic abuse. It just means that they didn't press charges for whatever reason. Could be insufficient evidence, somebody changed their story, who knows. I could have sworn one of the original news stories about what happened claimed that he admitted to the cops what had happened when they arrived, but in any event, I talked about the story when it first broke, so I wanted to give the update here on the show. So there you go. Ring of Honor. Quick spoiler alert here. Ring of Honor held TV tapings a few days ago for its Glory by Honor event, and there was a major title change. So skip ahead about 30 seconds if you don't want to know what it is. After 567 days as the Ring of Honor television champion, Jay Lethal is champion no more. He lost his title to Roderick Strong in Kalamazoo, Michigan, which I was told was actually representing the Sound Off quite well, with the different Sound Off shirts there. That was on Friday night. I assume this is going to air on TV. My understanding is that these were TV tapings they were doing back-to-back nights. When it will air, I have no idea. But Jay Lethal's record-setting TV title reign has come to an end. He is, of course, still the Ring of Honor world champion. I watched the entire show last week. I really like the Adam Page-Jay Briscoe no-holds-barred match in the main event. These guys just beat the shit out of each other. BJ Whitmer, who's been on crutches for a while with an injury, he sat in on commentary with Kevin Kelly and Steve Corino, which you knew meant trouble because there's bad blood between Whitmer and Corino. Carino's son Colby has been one of BJ Whitmer's little disciples for a while now, taking advantage of the kid, and he just abuses him. And so Carino has no love lost for BJ Whitmer, but he's been warned before. You do not put your hands on him, because if you do, you'll be suspended. So remember that. Colby wasn't at ringside for this match, but Adam Page is another one. Adam Page, they talk about him like he's going to be a big star one day, and you know, he may well be, but for now, he's taking orders from BJ Whitmer, and Whitmer is the one who got into his head all those weeks ago and told him, you need to call out a big star. You need to call out Jay Briscoe. So he's been calling him out and calling him out and calling him out, and it all led to this. There was a spot in this match. It was a crazy match. A lot of tables and mayhem and all that kind of stuff, chairs. Jay Briscoe at one point gave Adam Page a J-Driller, which is a brutal enough move. He gave him a J-Driller through the table on the floor. Now, I know he's done this spot before. He did the spot in the match with Jay Lethal, where Jay beat him for the championship. When I see a move like that, and the guy immediately rolls the person back into the ring and gets a near fall, I just shake my head. Like, a spot like that is done for a near fall. You spiked this guy off the apron through a table. I mean, that's your finish. It's not even just a move. That's your finish. And you do it through a table on the floor. And he only gets a near fall. Meanwhile, what did he win the match with? A J-Driller. Clean in the middle of the ring. Now, the story they're trying to tell here is that this kid, he took a brutal beating and he just would not quit. He would not give up. And that's fine. That's perfectly fine. You could tell that story. That's the kind of thing I have a problem with, though. When they do something like that, to me, it's just stupid. Like, you do that move for a near fall, and then a few minutes later, he hits the move normal in the ring and pins him. It's a little ass backwards to me. I don't know. Ring of Honor used to go overboard all the time with the near falls and kickouts from finishers. It's better now than it was a couple of years ago. But I saw that and I just was like, come on. Like, that's a near fall, really? I don't know if that bothered anybody else. It bothered me. So BJ Whitmer gets in the ring after the match. He starts beating on Briscoe with the crutch. I guess revealing he didn't need the crutches anymore. This is too much for Steve Corino to bear. He very calmly gets up from the announce desk. He climbs into the ring. He removes his suit jacket. Pulls out what I think was a roll of quarters. And nails Whitmer right in the face with it. Knocks him out. Whitmer had been goading him into doing it. He's like, hit me, because he knew if Carino laid a finger on him, he'd be gone. And Carino did just that. And Carino knew it too. He left the ring, he hugged Kevin Kelly, and he walked off. So it's a good angle, fun match, I enjoyed it. The Jay Driller through the table for the near fall, again, it's a minor thing, it annoyed me, but it didn't take away from how much fun this was. Lucha Underground, real quick here before we get to the mailbag, there's a rumor going around. I believe it may be credited to The Observer or Brian Alvarez over at Figure Four. I'm not sure, but it's a rumor at this point. It is not confirmed, but the belief is that Lucha Underground just got a huge infusion of cash from who or where, I don't know, but they got a huge infusion of cash that will allow them to not only do season two of the show, but immediately turn around and record season three, back to back, two and three. That's huge, if that's true. The other rumored aspect to this story is that Lucha Underground going forward, I don't know if this is just season two or season three, but it's going to have more of a quote-unquote space alien influence on the show. Now, if you were to tell me that WWE or TNA was going to have more of a space alien influence, first of all, I would tell you that I think space aliens are running TNA. But beside that, that would bother me. Because that just doesn't work with WWE or TNA or Ring of Honor. But I've said before, Lucha Underground is none of those things. Lucha Underground has a lot of supernatural elements to it. It's like a comic book come to life. and it just works. It doesn't bother me as much. There are some things that are just completely goofy, but, you know, by and large, it doesn't bother me as much. And I don't know if that's just because, again, it fits the world that they live in, or I'm able to excuse it because the rest of the product is so freaking great. Whatever it is, I hear this, it gives me a little reason to be concerned, but I find that, you know, my attitude about it is, all right, let's see what happens. I have so much faith and trust in these people, so much goodwill that they built up with me after that first season. They may turn around in season two and shit the bed. Who knows, right? This is only going to be the second season. But I have enough faith in the people who run this show that I'm okay with it. I'm going to let it play out. I have faith and I have a lot of optimism that this is going to turn out to be great. And we'll see what happens. I wouldn't have that same optimism if it were anybody else but Lucha Underground. So we'll see. We'll see what that means. Space alien influence. I mean, we already saw people kind of vanishing up in fireballs into the stars, and we saw a lot of wacky shit during that first season. I don't know how much more wacky they could possibly make it. Time for the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email them to me, thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Nick from Boston. Recently, Tyrus was on Sam Roberts' podcast and mentioned during his WWE tenure being stuck in the middle with no direction. Do you think Brodus Clay had a higher ceiling with the company, or did he plateau? Had he debuted with another gimmick, do you think he could have been a main eventer? Well, I mean, here's the thing with Brodus Clay. When he debuted as the Funkasaurus, I was one of the few people who took a more positive view of it, even though we were all expecting him to be this monster, right? That's how they were building him up, and they kept putting it off and putting it off and putting it off. And he just showed up. Now, it's not like he hadn't already been on TV. He had already debuted. He was a bodyguard for Alberto Del Rio. He was doing that bodyguard stuff for a while there. And as is the case with a lot of different characters in WWE, they change their mind or they don't know what they want to do with you. So they kept him off TV. They bring him back. He's the dancing jolly Funkasaurus. And I remember saying at that time, this could be huge. I don't know if I said main eventer. I don't think I did. But I did say, let's give it a shot. Let's see where it goes. This guy could sell a ton of merchandise. And the more merch he sells, the more he'll be featured. And he could really get this over. But my idea, now, to be fair to me, first of all, I was wrong. But to be fair to me, my idea was not doing it exactly the way they did it. My idea was, he comes out, he's the dancing, fun-loving Funkasaurus, but in his matches, when you punch him in the mouth or you hit a big move on him, you piss him off. And the guy has a mean streak and the monster comes out and then he just fucks shit up. That was kind of the way I looked at it. So you could do all the goofy, funny stuff, but you can still get that other side of Brodus Clay. We never got the other side. He was just Brodus Clay, the dancing, jolly, fat guy. And that just was never going to work. Even if he would have debuted with like a monster type gimmick, no. I don't. And all due respect to him, I mean, you know, he seems like a decent guy and all that. But look, some people just are not meant to be in the main event. And when I watch him, especially when I watch some of his stuff in TNA as Tyrus, I mean, he's not that good. Like, just as a fan, I watch and I'm like, you know, he's one of the weaker parts of the show, I think. And again, I don't mean that in a mean way, but I don't see main event appeal. Like, you know, what I want to see Brodus Clay, again, with the proper gimmick, not with that character, in matches with John Cena and in matches with Daniel Bryan and Randy Orton. No, there's 20 or 30 guys ahead of him who I would much rather see in the main event. I never saw him as a main eventer then. I don't see him as a main eventer now. But that doesn't mean that he didn't get screwed over by WWE. He absolutely did. But as a main eventer, no, I don't see it. Davis from Scottsdale, Arizona. One of my favorite nostalgia moments from 2002 would have been when Shawn Michaels won the World Heavyweight title at Survivor Series. What would you say if he kept the title through WrestleMania and defended it against Chris Jericho? I would have been perfectly fine with that. In fact, I think that would have been a much better match than Triple H and Booker T at WrestleMania. You have a title on the line in that first Jericho-Shawn match? That would have been great. I mean, you still headlined the show with Kurt and Brock for the other championship. You had two titles at the time. But yeah, I think that would have been a fine idea. And then they can go on and continue feuding throughout much of 2003. Now, of course, if you do that, I don't know if we end up getting the world title program we got in 2008 between the two of them. So there's a trade-off there, because that feud in 08 was the feud of the year. And their matches were probably match of the year. I mean, it was great, but we may not get that if they already did it 5 years earlier. Sherrod from Dallas. Was the plan always to put the WCW title back on Hollywood Hogan after Starrcade 97? I ask because after the rematch on Nitro, WCW held up the belt until Super Brawl, which Sting won, but then lost to Macho Man not even two full months later. And then the next night, Hogan beats Savage and becomes the champion again. What was that all about? Well, that's Hogan being Hogan. That's what that is. You know, put it this way. The plan was always to put the title back on Hulk Hogan anytime he lost it. Okay? So not just in this case. If he lost it, then yes, the plan was to ultimately get the belt back on Hulk Hogan. It was probably written that way into his contract. Harry from Winnipeg, you idiot. Why does WWE keep reminding us that the Attitude Era was so much better than today's wrestling? On Raw 1000, you had DX come out and completely run down and beat up Damian Sandow. You had Kane and Undertaker take out 10 men. You had The Rock interrupt Daniel Bryan and CM Punk and made Bryan look like a jobber. That show was made to bring back old fans, but all it did was showcase that all of these new guys suck and you should be glad you stayed away. Then they have Triple H kick Curtis Axel in the balls, The Rock runs off the undefeated Rusev, the APA Outlaws and NWO make fun of the Ascension. Well, they deserve that, to be fair. And finally, you have Shawn Michaels running down Seth Rollins this past Monday. The champ. Well, you mean the chump. Why should we care about anybody on the roster when it's obvious they're geeks in comparison to the stars of the past? I thought the whole point of bringing back legends was to build up the new stars in the eyes of the fans. No, the point of bringing back legends is to pop a rating. I don't care what anybody else says. That's their motivation. That's it. Whether it's popping a rating or if maybe they're going to be on the pay-per-view that weekend, selling network subscriptions, whatever it may be, that's the motivation. Because as you just pointed out, their actions sure as hell don't show you a company that wants to use those guys to help elevate anybody other than those guys. I think you hit the nail right on the head. You're absolutely right. They constantly beat us over the head with the Attitude Era, the Attitude Era, the Attitude Era. Why? So they can sell DVDs. So they can sell network subscriptions. And I shouldn't even say sell, because they give that shit away for free every month. That's why they do it. I mean, can you imagine if when Shawn Michaels was champion in 1997, let's say, in the state that he was in, if they brought back superstar Billy Graham to cut a promo on him in the ring about how he dresses like a girl and he could never be the next Billy Graham because there's only one superstar Billy Graham, you think Shawn Michaels would stand there and take that? Of course not. He would eviscerate Billy Graham in the most disrespectful way he could think because he's the champion and because he's Shawn Michaels and that's just what he does. He actually had balls. None of those guys back then, if they were constantly put on TV with the legends of yesteryear, go back to the New Generation era in the mid-90s, you had Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels and Big Daddy Cool Diesel and Razor Ramon and Undertaker. Can you imagine if they were trotting out Billy Graham and Bob Backlund, I guess, was there, but Bruno Sammartino and guys from that era, right? Tony Atlas, Rocky Johnson, whoever. Constantly trotting them out on Raw and on Superstars and Wrestling Challenge and making the newer guys almost seem inferior by comparison or running them down on the microphone without giving them the opportunity sometimes to even respond. I can't even imagine that. None of those guys back then would even be booked to stand there and do nothing and take the abuse, let alone actually have the opportunity to kind of talk back or do anything like that. They wouldn't even be booked that way in the first place. And WWE does this constantly now, unless you're John Cena or Roman Reigns. Then they'll send Ric Flair out there to lick your balls on live TV. Jerome from San Jose. What was a better gimmick match? The Prince of Darkness match with Jake Roberts and the model Rick Martel? Did they actually call it that? The Prince of Darkness match. I thought it was just a blindfold match. I don't know if they ever used that name. Maybe they did. Let me say that again. I just lost my train of thought. What was the better gimmick match? The Prince of Darkness match with Jake and the Model, or Shawn Michaels against the Model at SummerSlam where they couldn't hit each other in the face? Well, it's like the lesser of two evils, I guess, right? Not the best gimmick stipulations in the world. I will say this, though. If you're asking me, like, in theory, what's the better stipulation, I'd say the match where you can't hit the other guy in the face, because you can pretty much do everything else. If anything, I think it makes the match maybe even a little better just to see what these guys come up with, because they can't do the traditional, I'll punch you, I'll elbow you in the face. They've got to be creative and think of other ways to make the match interesting. So I would pick that match, but of the two matches you mentioned, I thought the blindfold match was better. I enjoyed that more. And most blindfold matches, they've done them since, they usually suck. But the match with Jake and Martel, and they had the crowd into it and everything, I thought just the way they did that match, yeah, I mean, it's a little slow in parts, because they're trying to pretend they don't see each other, even though they do. But I just thought the way it was laid out, I enjoyed it. I thought it was actually a pretty enjoyable match. The other match with Shawn and Rick Martel, I don't remember much about it except the finish, which involved Sherry. Sherry was kind of torn between the two of them, and she took a bump, and I remember there being this great shot of her ass as she was being carried out. It sticks out of my mind for some reason. Other than that, I don't remember much about the match, and I would think those two guys could probably go out there and have a pretty good match, and I don't remember it being anything special. So, of the two they did, I like the blindfold one, but between the stipulations, I would think the other one would be better. Nick says, I wanted to know your thoughts on all these people making homophobic comments towards Tyler Breeze. Well, I haven't seen a lot of that myself, but my guess is that these people themselves are gay, and they're just projecting onto other people. Those who talk constantly about that kind of stuff usually are the ones that they themselves have something to hide. And I'll leave it at that. Danny from the Bronx, who is John Cena's greatest rival? You know, I thought about this when I first saw Danny's email, and I kind of plucked it out. I thought about Edge, I thought about CM Punk, not so much Randy Orton, because WWE makes it out to be this legendary rivalry, which it's really not. You know, just putting two people in the ring together 1,000 times doesn't automatically make it legendary. But it wasn't any of those guys. John Cena's greatest rival is the fans. It's true, right? It's become so much a part of him that I don't know where John Cena as a character today would be if it wasn't for kind of the love-hate relationship that the fans have with this guy. Because it's just 13 years later, after he made his debut, and really the booing didn't start until 05. So let's say for the last decade, they've been doing the yay boo, let's go Cena, Cena sucks, and it's gotten worse just in terms of the hate, like the pure hatred toward him. Now that he's been around for so long, it's turned from we don't like you to we don't like you because you're still around, go away. But it's all about John Cena and the fans, right? How the fans are going to react to him. What city are they in this week? How are the fans going to react? It's like this every single week, every single month, every single year. It never changes. So when I think back to the John Cena character and you're asking me, who's his greatest rival? Who do I associate most of all with John Cena? It's not any one person. It's the fans. It's just part of his whole gimmick, his whole legacy. I mean, whatever word you want to use for it, that to me is his biggest rival. Now, if you wanted me to pick an individual, I'd probably go with CM Punk. But I think the fans is the answer to that question. Aiden from Ireland. I recently finished watching WrestleMania 20. Seeing Benoit and Eddie in the center of the ring is a moment I'll never forget. And it got me thinking, is the WrestleMania moment WWE really wanted what we ended up getting? With the rumors of Lesnar leaving for the NFL, did WWE have to resort to giving the title to Eddie, who was the crowd favorite at the time, at No Way Out instead of Mania to ensure they had a guaranteed champion after Mania? Or was Lesnar's match with Goldberg always in the pipeline? Also, rewatching the Royal Rumble that year, I noticed that Benoit did not receive an outstanding pop or anything like that. Was Benoit winning always the plan? Was he a late replacement for somebody else? His reign was extremely short and seemed as if he just was awarded the belt to fill the gap between Triple H losing and Randy Orton winning. In short, is Benoit and Eddie ending WrestleMania 20 a WrestleMania moment that WWE did not want? Well, they didn't want it, I don't think. Probably not, right? I don't think Chris or Eddie were their ideal choices to put the title on because they were so small compared to some of the bigger guys they had on that roster. Most of the guys were big, and they were smaller. So I think they had to work a little bit harder. They got themselves over enough where WWE felt comfortable putting the belts on them. But if you went to Vince McMahon and say, hey, Vince, in a perfect world, your 20th anniversary, well, they called it that, but the 20th anniversary of WrestleMania back in Madison Square Garden, a big landmark show. Do you honestly, in your mind, think that Vince McMahon's grand vision of what he would have wanted to end WrestleMania 20 was Eddie Guerrero and Chris Benoit in the ring with both belts? I don't buy that for a second. I don't believe that for 1 second. But to their credit, they went with it because Eddie was over and Benoit was over, not as much as Eddie was, but Benoit had that rep as being a hard worker and legitimately the best wrestler, and he deserves it, right? This whole no-show, he deserves it. And so it just made for a great story. Now, it's depressing as all fuck to go back and watch that now, but at the time, people had tears in their eyes. It was a very emotional thing. It was a cool moment. Now, you mentioned that Benoit's reign was extremely short. It really wasn't that short. I mean, he held the championship from WrestleMania to SummerSlam. There's been a lot of guys who have held the title from WrestleMania to SummerSlam, I'm sure. And what is that, 5 months, 6 months? I mean, that's a decent amount of time. Sometimes guys now, they'll win a belt 1 week, they'll lose it the next, they'll lose it, you know, a month later, 2 months later. So I don't think Benoit's run was that short. But I don't think going into it, they ever intended to keep the title on him for any extended period of time. I don't think the idea was, hey, we're going to put the belt on Benoit and he's going to have it for a year. They kind of knew, all right, let's put it on him. Let's see how he does. You know, maybe he'll knock it out of the park and business will shoot up and it'll shock all of us and then we'll just run with it. And that didn't happen. So they gave him his little run and then his run was over. And they went with the younger guy. And a big part of why they went with Randy Orton when they did was they were so... And this was the year that Brock walked out. I'll talk about Brock in a second. So Brock had left earlier in the year. Now Brock, at SummerSlam, actually a few years earlier, became the youngest WWE champion of all time. Now this was the world title. This was not the WWE title that Randy Orton won. But when Orton won it, they played it up. The youngest world champion ever. The youngest world champion ever. In large part, I think, because they didn't want to have to talk about Brock Lesnar as being the youngest world champion ever. So it's kind of like Nikki Bella now is the longest reigning Divas champion. Okay, great. Now we don't have to talk about AJ Lee. It's kind of that same petty mentality of now Randy Orton is the new young champion, and we don't ever have to refer to Brock Lesnar when it comes to that kind of thing ever again. So would he have held the championship were it not for that? I mean, who's to say? If Brock sticks around, everything changes. I mean, who the hell knows what happens, right? And you mentioned Brock was the plan always to do Brock and Goldberg. They first teased a match between Brock and Goldberg, I want to say, at Survivor Series. Now, maybe my timeline is off, but I'm pretty sure it's not. I don't think it was the Rumble. Because the Rumble... I think the Rumble is when Brock interfered and helped eliminate Goldberg, or at least distracted him, and I think Goldberg may have gotten dumped out by Kurt Angle. So the first little tease of something between Brock and Goldberg, I think, was a backstage segment at Survivor Series the year before when both of them were champion. I vaguely remember both of them having belts, and they kind of went face-to-face. So I'm sure Brock and Goldberg was in the pipeline for many months before it happened. I think that match was happening no matter what. I don't think his leaving impacted when Eddie won the belt, because I'm pretty sure, and again, my timeline can be off, somebody will check, but I'm pretty sure that Brock didn't tell Vince for sure that he was gone and WrestleMania was going to be his last match until March. So the title change with Eddie happened in February. So I'm pretty sure that would have went down exactly as it did no matter what, and that would have set up as it did, it would have set up Brock and Goldberg because they first teased that match at the Survivor Series many months earlier. So I think that would have happened no matter what. Michael from Lusk, Wyoming. If Sean Oliver from Kayfabe Commentary signed with WWE right now, what would be his role and how would he be used? They'd probably just make him a backstage interviewer. But I'll tell you what, you know, Sean Oliver is really good. I like him. Me personally, I would have him doing similar types of shoots on the network, but I know they would never do that. So instead, I actually think he'd be perfect for the role if they ever wanted to do like a late night talk show kind of deal on the network, wrestling themed, obviously. I have nothing to base that off of other than the shoots I've seen him host, but he's got the personality for it, and I think he's got the interview skills for it. So that's what I would do with him. Mark from Massachusetts, buy or sell the Steiner Brothers, circa 1989 to 1995, or the Dudley Boys in whatever you would consider their prime to be. I'm going to go with the Steiner Brothers, especially from that time period. The Steiner Brothers, they were not a team, I think, if you were, especially if you were an enhancement guy, that you wanted to find yourself across the ring from, because they had no mercy. I don't know if they took liberties with, it certainly looked like they were taking liberties with guys in there. But they were just brutal. I mean, you go back and watch some of those Scott Steiner, Rick Steiner matches against the Jobbers on Raw in like 93. I wish I remember what episode it was. I want to say it was the fall of 93. Somewhere around then, it might have been a Raw that they taped at the Civic Center in Poughkeepsie. It wasn't from the Manhattan Center. It was definitely a smaller, different venue. And this memory just sticks out in my head, and I may have watched this on the network maybe last year, but Scott Steiner gave this guy, I think he had him up maybe for a vertical suplex, and he held him up there, and then he kind of like maybe threw him up in the air a little bit, but he turned it into a sitting tombstone pile driver and just fucking spiked this guy headfirst into the mat. It was a miracle this guy lived. I don't know how he survived. And that was commonplace. These guys would beat the shit out of these other guys. But here's the thing about it, right? So they looked like a bunch of dicks when they were doing that, but they came off as legitimately tough guys, and I'm sure they were. You know, from their background and everything, I wouldn't want to pick a fight with them. And maybe that's one of the things that's missing from wrestling today. You don't have a lot of guys aside from Brock, who, when you watch them on TV, they come off as like these legitimately tough guys that I would not want to fucking bump into in a dark alley somewhere. They could be scary. The Steiner Brothers were legit tough guys, or at least they came off that way. And they were also a great team. As wrestlers, I thought they were a very good team. And they had some great battles with Money Inc. I mean, you go back a little earlier, you mentioned 89 to 95, so that includes part of their WCW run. One of my favorite matches in WCW during that period, not that I was watching a lot of WCW, but I've gone back, there was a Super Brawl match with the Steiners against Sting and Lex Luger. You know, that I love that match. So, as performers, they were great. Now, the Dudley Boys got better over time. I wouldn't say their prime was in ECW, although that was the prime of Bubba Ray Dudley as a heel doing and saying heinous things to people in the crowd that unfortunately he can't get away with doing now in WWE. But as performers in the ring and matches and all that kind of stuff, I don't know, if I had to pick a peak period for the Dudley Boys, you know what? In some ways, I would almost even say now, just from an in-ring perspective, because they look as good now as they did before, and they're actually smaller, they're in better shape, they lost some of the weight. I mean, toward the end of their WWE run, it was not good, okay? So, if not now, then I'd have to say shortly after they came in. That 2001 period, I guess I would say would be their peak. The whole TLC period with Edge and Christian and the Hardys and the Dudleys. For the Dudleys, I think that was their peak. And they look as good now, physically in the ring, as they did back then. That, to me, would be their peak. I can't say that I would put them ahead of the Steiner Brothers. Just overall, as wrestlers and tough guys and whatever measure you would use to compare the two teams and say, oh, they're better than them. Promos, okay? Let's say promos. The Dudley Boys, when they were allowed to cut promos, Bubba turned out to be a hell of a promo guy. But we never got to see that, though. We didn't really see what he was capable of on the microphone, I don't think, until he went to TNA. And they gave him a chance as Bully Ray to kind of break out as the single star. You know, that's one of the things that I find kind of sad now with him being back in WWE. They don't allow him to kind of do a little bit of that. It's just right back to Bubba Ray Dudley doing the Dudley Boys thing and tables. And it just makes the character very one-dimensional. Now, maybe if he sticks around long enough, not that I'd want to split them up, but maybe they'll allow him to start to do more of that. Maybe. Probably not. So, as promos, Bubba had some chops there on the microphone. You just didn't get a chance to see it a lot. Scott Steiner, and again, we're talking from that period, 89 to 95. You know, look, it was a different time in wrestling. I don't remember a whole lot of Scott Steiner promos. You know, you didn't have guys coming out and standing in the middle of the ring for 15 minutes cutting a fucking promo at the beginning of every show. Thank Christ. You know, thank God. I wish we can go back to that. And I'll also throw this in, you know, when I think, as far as Scott Steiner, for example, you're talking during that 89 to 95 period, to me, that was Scott Steiner at his best. I know people get a kick out of the whole Big Papa Pump character and those, you know, nonsensical promos. It's very entertaining. But as a performer in the ring before he did whatever the hell it is he did and his body just completely transformed, because he was already a big guy. He was muscular, he was big, and then he went off the rails with it. And he started to get hurt a lot, and he couldn't move around the way that he used to. He wasn't as quick and explosive. So before he got into all that stuff, Scott Steiner, I think he could have been a world champion. And he got a little bit of a push as a singles there in WCW in the early 90s. I think he even had a title match against Ric Flair, and there may have been a plan to put the title on Steiner, but it didn't happen. I don't remember the whole story behind that. That was Scott Steiner to me at his physical peak. His physical prime was during those years. And the stuff he could do as a bigger guy, I mean, the Frankensteiner, shooting the guy into the ropes, he times it just perfectly, jumps into the air. I mean, that did more damage to Scott Steiner than anything else because he kept landing on his neck and his shoulder. But I'll take that Scott Steiner over the Scott Steiner of the late 90s, early 2000s. You know, he really developed his character, but physically in the ring, he was a shell. A shell of his former self. I mean, you can't even compare the two. You can't compare Scott Steiner from the late 80s, early 90s to Scott Steiner during the Monday Night Wars. As far as in the ring, athleticism, there is no comparison. Overall, I just got to go with the Steiner brothers. It's just, I can't say that that I find the Dudleys overall to be better than the Steiners. They're just, the Steiners had something about them that, you know, intangible, that just puts them over the edge to me. So I would say buy on the Steiner brothers at their peak and sell on the Dudley boys at their peak. One last thing before we move on. Somebody sent me a link on Twitter to an article on What Culture that was from several weeks ago after one of the episodes of Raw. It was the episode of Raw where I think Andrew, it was, I hope I'm remembering his name, had that great wrestling soup, Salamonster sign, dead center there on the hard camera, and they flashed it on TV a couple of times, more than a couple of times. So there was an article, I guess a Raw review or a slideshow or whatever the hell this is, on whatculture.com that somebody did, and the title is 41 What the Fuck Moments from WWE Raw. It was the October 12th episode of Monday Night Raw, Columbus Day. And number 28... on the countdown is Wrestling Soup Salamonster. And it has a sign, the screenshot of the sign. And this is what the person said underneath. That sign just behind Nikki Bella's arm there. To me, this is nothing more than a group of words plunged together in a random order. But to someone more informed than me, it will either mean an insult to Bella or possibly the name of a podcast or radio show. Now, not that everybody in the world is expected to know the name of Wrestling Soup or Salamonster Sounds Off, but I just thought it was funny that to this person who saw this sign, he couldn't understand what the fuck it meant. Like, Wrestling Soup Salamonster, what the hell does that even mean? It's just a bunch of random words put together. And I'm sure somebody has schooled this person by now. Time to reveal match number 6 in the countdown, 8 of my favorite WWE matches of all time. As I mentioned earlier, this match was from the same city as Raw this past Monday, Dallas, Texas, only with a much livelier crowd. Now, I had said that there was only one match on this entire countdown that is not currently available on the WWE Network for you guys to pull up and watch. That's not true. There's actually two matches in this countdown. This is one of them. I thought this match was available on the network, but it turns out the entire year still hasn't been uploaded yet. This is from 2000. And they have Raws from 98, from 99, from 2001, 2002, or SmackDown from 02. Nothing. No Raw whatsoever from 2000. I have no idea why. So you'll have to find this on YouTube. I know it's on there. It was a 10-man tag from Reunion Arena in Dallas, Texas. It was Triple H, X-Pac, Chris Benoit, Dean Malenko, and Perry Saturn against The Rock, Cactus Jack, Rikishi, and Too Cool. This is, by far, one of the best matches in Raw history. It is one of the most fun matches I've ever seen. Everybody was over in this match. Everybody was so over in this match on a level that is so far above 98% of the people on TV now, it's scary. Everybody got a chance to shine in this match. Everybody had their moment. I don't think they took a single commercial break during this match. I went back and watched it. The version online that I watched was actually divided up on YouTube into two parts. I don't recall seeing a single commercial break during that match, which is something else that annoys me to no end now about the show. Whatever it was, they at least were able to pace things in such a way where when you had a big match like this, and the match, you know, wasn't a long, long match, but the match had to be at least, you know, 10, 12 minutes. They didn't take a single break. They didn't interrupt the action. And there was a lot of it. And it helped. On Raw sometimes now you watch, and maybe because it's 3 hours, it's like every five fucking minutes you take a commercial break, and then you take one in the middle of a match. Sometimes they take two in the middle of a match. Their new thing now is every time there's a Divas match, they start it up for about a minute or two, and they go right to a commercial break. That's the new thing now. So let's just give a little bit of background here on what was going on. And I talked about October of 2000 at the beginning of the show, when I was talking about, you know, the last time the Mets were in the World Series, here's what was going on. So I'm kind of going back to WWF again in 2000 here, but at the time, Austin was gone. Austin had neck surgery in January of 2000, so he was out. Thankfully for WWE, they had an equally big megastar in The Rock, who was bigger than ever. I don't mean literally, but as a star, he was bigger than ever. And when I say they're lucky, I mean, think about it, right? You would be fortunate to have a star on the level of Stone Cold Steve Austin, just one star like that, ever, okay? At any given moment, to have one guy like that would be amazing. They had two. Rock got so hot, he was basically on the same level as Austin. Maybe you could say a shade below, because I still look at Austin as being like right here, but The Rock was practically right there with him. So when Austin went down, if they didn't have somebody like The Rock, they would have been in a lot of trouble. And I'm not going to say, well, WCW would have ended up coming back and beating them in the Monday Night Wars. WCW was so far gone by that point, that would not have happened. And they had a lot of talent on that roster. I think they would have been okay. But, you know, Undertaker was out injured at the time, and it would have been bad. The Rock was just in another stratosphere. That's how popular he was. Triple H was on the ascent during this period. Okay, this was right in the middle of his feud with Cactus Jack. He had just had the street fight with him at the Royal Rumble, which is one of the best matches in Rumble history. And that was the match that, for me at least, cemented Triple H as a main eventer. I didn't look at him that way before that match. You know, he was kind of almost there, but I didn't really look at Triple H as being anything special until he had that match with Foley. And I wasn't even really a fan of the Hell in a Cell match they had, to be honest with you. But that street fight at the Rumble opened my eyes to this guy, like, okay, now I could take this guy seriously. And they had just had that match. The Radicals had just defected from WCW. What a disaster for them that was. They let those guys go. So it's Benoit, Eddie, Saturn, Malenko. They had just debuted on television the week before. They were sitting in the crowd on Raw. Remember that? And then they got involved. That was only the week before this. And the very next night at the SmackDown tapings, it was Eddie. I don't know if it was Eddie and Chris or Eddie and Perry. I don't know. But it was a tag team match against the New Age Outlaws. And Eddie Guerrero, when he landed, he did the frog splash and he dislocated his elbow. His first night. First match. And he dislocated his elbow. Talk about a tough break. So he was out there here for this match. He just wasn't part of the actual match. He had his arm in a sling. You had Rikishi and Too Cool. Rikishi and Too Cool had just gotten together as an act on TV. They could not have been together for that long. I know they had the spot in the Royal Rumble that year where they were the only ones in the ring, and then the lights went out, and they did the dance. It was a great spot, and then Rikishi dumped them both out. But Rikishi, if you remember when they did the whole who ran down Steve Austin storyline and they revealed it was Rikishi, I did it. Okay, they talked about the fact that Rikishi hadn't even debuted on TV at that point. That was in November of 99. So at some point between the end of November 99 and where we are now at the beginning of February of 2000, he first had debuted. So these guys were not together very long. And that act was so fucking over. It was unbelievable. I mean, Rikishi and Grandmaster Sexay and Scotty Too Hotty, you know, who the fuck would these guys have been? No, you know, nobody would have cared. But they put them together and the act just took off. It just worked. So even the guys that were, like, you know, mid-carders in this match, everybody felt like a main eventer. Everybody felt like a fucking rock star out there. So that kind of sets the stage for what was going on here. The crowd was hot. I mean, you talk about a hot crowd, a lively crowd. I don't know if they were like this for the entire episode of Raw, but I know how they were for this match. And this has got to be one of the best crowds they've ever had for a Raw show ever. I don't know how you would even rank them, because how the fuck are you supposed to remember crowds from one week to the next? But this one stands out. These people were going nuts. Reunion Arena had a lot of wrestling history in it. You know, World Class used to run events there with the Von Erichs. It's not there anymore. They tore it down a few years ago. They had done an angle. Earlier in the night, Eddie Guerrero came out with the rest of the Radicals, and he was thanking the fans for giving them a chance to perform in front of them, however brief their time may have been. They had just debuted, but they had no contracts, right? They were outsiders, and they were going to have to go. And they were very convincing. And Cactus Jack had come out, and Triple H then came out, and they were still in the middle of building to the Foley-Triple H rematch at Hell in a Cell, where Foley's career would be on the line, and the title. And Cactus had his back turned to the Radicals. He's in the ring with them. Triple H is just entering the ring, and he says to the Radicals, although he didn't realize that at first, who he was talking to, he said, "You can show your appreciation to the guy that just gave you your contracts." And that was their cue to attack Cactus, turn them heel. They all ganged up on him. And later in the show, we got a great Foley promo backstage before the match. He was going to go it alone. The Rock is going to be his partner, not because he asked him to be. And he's going to go in there, and he's going to fight, and he's going to beat Triple H at the pay-per-view, and he's going to go on to have his WrestleMania moment. Because that was the other storyline they were building. Mick Foley never had his big WrestleMania moment. I think Foley since then has admitted that it was just a storyline. He didn't give a shit. And he regrets coming back at WrestleMania 2000 that year. He shouldn't have done it, but that was the narrative, right? It was his dream to have a WrestleMania moment, so he talked about that. So it's time for the match. Triple H and X-Pac come out first. Out come the Radicals. And I had forgotten how bad Lillian Garcia was when she first started out. Her first night, I believe her very first night, on TV anyway, was the night after SummerSlam in 99. Now, how do I remember this? I remember this because that was the night that Triple H won his first WWF title. And I remember it wasn't Howard Finkel, it's this new girl, and she sucks. Well, she didn't get any better in the months that followed, and out come the Radicals, and she says, "Being accompanied to the ring by Eddie Guerrero." So this poor fucker gets hurt in his first match in, and now they can't even pronounce his name right. Stephanie McMahon, Triple H's wife, out there on commentary for the match. I would say that's probably the one blight on this match is Stephanie's commentary. She gets very annoying as the match goes on. A couple of highlights from the match. There was one point where Chris Benoit gave Rikishi a release German suplex. Rikishi was a big man. He landed, I mean, he folded up like an accordion, just all that weight coming down on his neck like that. I cringed watching that. There was another spot, it was Benoit and Perry Saturn, and they whipped Grandmaster Sexay into the ropes. They gave him a double, you know, back elbow, and then they did the double snot spot, where they both kind of blow snot out of their noses on him. Just fucking gross. And Jim Ross is like, "Oh, that's so classy." And Stephanie, to her credit, this was kind of funny. She's like chuckling, and she goes, "I thought it was kind of cute myself, JR." And Jerry Lawler goes, "Yeah, they're just being snotty." See, so even Lawler's corny one-liners back then felt funnier than they do today. So the match, again, it's just on fire. Place is going nuts. Everybody is getting a chance to shine here. The Rock got the hot tag. You've never seen a hot tag like this before. Running wild on everybody. You know, spine buster, rock bottom. We had a little bit of a botch, kind of, at the finish. It didn't fuck anything up, but what happened was the whole match broke down. Everybody's brawling. Somewhere in here, Triple H gave Grandmaster Sexay a pedigree. Benoit was the legal man. He then came off the top, diving headbutt. That was the finish, okay? So he's pinning Grandmaster Sexay. As Earl Hebner drops down to count the fall, Cactus Jack comes and tries to break up the pin. He like falls down on Benoit with a forearm. And Triple H is standing there like, what are you doing, dude? He wasn't supposed to break up the pin. Now, any other match in WWE, when you do that, you break up the pin, right? Well, they weren't supposed to. So even though he hit Benoit, the ref just kept counting. So it looked a little weird. And that's how the match ended. And now it's just chaos and mayhem, and the heels are beating down the babyfaces, the New Age Outlaws, who were part of Heel DX with them at the time, or the McMahon-Helmsley regime, whatever. They run down with lead pipes. They're taking everybody out. The lights go out. They don't know what's going on. Stephanie accuses Jim Ross somehow of having a fucking button under the desk, I guess. You know, it's all your fault. What's going on, JR? And JR's like, I didn't do anything. Now there's a spotlight on the stage, and out walks a slim man in a red suit jacket. Now, it was being shot from afar, so you really couldn't tell who it was. People started to go nuts, though. They recognized who it was, and when they zoomed in, it was Paul Bearer. Paul Bearer lost a shit ton of weight. From the point that he had left the company in 99, I don't remember exactly when, it had to be in the summer at some point, because he had gotten very, very heavy. So he shows up looking as slim as he's probably been since he made his debut, really. And out comes Kane. They hit his pyro, Kane walks out, and Jim Ross is on commentary, practically just orgasmic, talking about, Kane is back! Kane is back! Now, the funny thing about that was that Kane was only gone for like 2 weeks. You know, I know for a fact he was in the Royal Rumble match, and the Royal Rumble was only 2 weeks before this. So, it was funny listening to JR just losing his shit about how Kane is back. I just remember thinking even then, like, I didn't know he left. And you know, for as over-the-top as Jim Ross could be, that's what made him so great. At least he cared. He made everything feel more important than it was, and the things that actually were important, he made them feel legendary. And that's yet another thing. I hate to keep coming back to this like a broken record, but I do like drawing comparisons to then and now to kind of illustrate the things they're doing wrong now, with the hope that maybe they'll kind of figure it out on their own and get back to doing it. I don't know what the answer is here. You're not bringing back Jim Ross. It's just the way that they do things, the way they produce their announcers now. It doesn't feel like there's any life to it. It just doesn't feel like there's any life to it. At least Jim Ross, with his calls back then, you can't say he didn't bring life and energy to it, because he did. Now, Kane comes out, and I'm curious to see if you guys would agree with me on this. There's been a lot of debate over the years about Kane and his masks and his attire, his outfits, and which was better. And some people think the best incarnation of Kane was Monster Psycho Kane, who was already unmasked and came out with the chains on and the towel over his head. I mean, that was pretty badass. I don't agree that was the best version of him, but that was pretty cool for the time it lasted. When Kane walked out here, and I rewatched this, I remembered that this was new attire for him. I don't think he was using the attire yet that he had walked out here wearing. I think he was still wearing the old traditional, just, you know, red Kane costume with the one sleeve and the black trim and the mostly red mask. The mask he walked out wearing here, I don't know if it was the same one and it was just faded or what. It was mostly black. It had a little bit of red, but it was mostly black. The outfit he was wearing here, I think, also was mostly black with a little bit of red. I think it was completely sleeveless. Now I can't remember all of a sudden. But I think he was sleeveless, and he was jacked. This guy was jacked to the gills. I'm not accusing him of anything, I'm just saying big, right? He was big and muscular as I can remember seeing him. And when he came out and he climbed up onto the apron, and all the heels are just cowering. They're all banding together in the ring. And there's this great camera shot of Kane now standing on the apron, just towering over everybody. I look at this version of Kane, the way he looked, you know, maybe at his physical peak at this point, the costume, the mask. This, to me, was the best that Kane has looked his entire 18-year run. This was the best look for Kane, including the original look, I think, of all the different ones that he's had. Now, I'm a big fan of that original mask. So, it was the same mask, but it just, the color was a little darker. It was a little off. But I do love the original mask. He was still using it here. But I just think his look, his color scheme, everything about the way that he looked when he walked out here, this to me was Kane at his best. Now, the other interesting thing about this, there was always a question in my mind of whether or not this spot was originally intended for The Undertaker. Whether The Undertaker maybe was going to make his return on this show instead of Kane. Or possibly even the Rumble. Because The Undertaker had been out with an injury for many months. If you remember, he was supposed to be part of the six-pack challenge in September of 99, and they pulled him out. They did an angle on TV where he basically quit, but they pulled him out of the match. I think he had some groin or hip issues. He was going to go away for a while. So he had been gone since September. He was due to come back. Now, I know for a fact that while he was training around that time, okay, January of 2000, he was training to come back. He was lifting, I think, in the gym, and he tore his pec muscle. So that kept him out for a few more months, and finally when he came back as the American Badass on the motorcycle. One of the very few WrestleManias, by the way, that year that he missed was in 2000. Now, something I did not know until earlier this year, and it's Kevin Nash, so my bullshit meter doesn't reach Hogan levels when I hear Nash tell stories, but I wouldn't exactly take what he says for gospel either. There was a story earlier in the year on the Sports Illustrated site. They had interviewed, I think, the different members of the NWO, and they were talking to Nash, and in the story, Nash claims that The Undertaker was very close to signing with WCW during this period while he was off healing up from his injuries. He said his contract was expiring, and they were trying to get him to come in, and Nash said that, you know, he wouldn't have been allowed to be the Dead Man Undertaker anymore, so that's where the idea came from for him to do the biker gimmick. He was going to come into WCW as the biker and go by his real name. And instead, he ended up re-signing with WWE and using the biker character there instead. I don't know how much of that is the truth. It fits. I mean, it kind of makes sense. It's one of those questions I would love for Steve Austin, maybe, to ask The Undertaker if he ever finally gets him on his podcast, which I thought was supposed to happen, and now I've heard nothing about that. But that's one of those questions I'd love for him to ask. We know how loyal Sting was to WCW all those years, but we also know that there were a couple of times that he negotiated with Vince McMahon, and he also could have made the jump to WWE, and he opted not to. Like, we know that already. I've never heard any of those same kind of stories about The Undertaker looking to jump to WCW. I mean, I'm sure he must have thought about it, especially during like those mid-90s years, but I don't remember there ever being any stories about him coming close or having a negotiation or having a phone call with Eric Bischoff or anything like that. He was always loyal to WWE, right? He was the loyal locker room leader of that company. So I would love to hear him talk about that. But anyway, Kane comes out, total beast mode. The best I've ever seen him. He lays waste to everybody in the ring, chokeslam to Saturn, chokeslam to Billy Gunn. I think on SmackDown that week, he gave Tori a tombstone, hence the name Tombstone Tori. I think that happened the very next night at the tapings. So everything about this segment, from the build-up to the match itself to the post-match stuff, was just everything that's so great about pro wrestling. And it's everything that's so great that made Raw great back in the day. There were a lot of things that made Raw great back in the day, but it was also having hot crowds that actually bought into what they were seeing. You know, there are some memories that I have of matches during that Attitude Era period, and I still consider 2000 to be the Attitude Era, even though that was kind of the beginning of the end of it. 2000 to me is part of the Attitude Era, which again is why I'm not sure why this whole year of shows isn't on the network yet. They have a whole fucking section dedicated to the Attitude Era. Maybe they just consider it from the point that Russo left. I don't know. But This, to me, was WWE's best year overall, top to bottom, was 2000. This match, with all the characters and everybody that was involved, all the new guys that had just jumped from WCW, and the headliners like Triple H and Rock and Foley, and the newer guys like Rikishi and Too Cool, everybody was accounted for. 2000, by the way, was also the rise of Kurt Angle, which just makes that year even more awesome. So yeah, if you've never seen this match before, and there's probably a lot of newer fans who haven't, who weren't even watching wrestling back then, weren't born, and it's not like you can go on the network and watch it, unfortunately. So go on YouTube, go on Daily Motion. The match is up there. It's in pretty decent quality. You might find it cut up into two parts. It is a fucking fantastic match, and just another reason why I love pro wrestling, which is why I picked it for my favorite matches countdown. It's like that Austin Dude Love match at Over the Edge in 98. Why did I pick that match, right? There's been so many better wrestling matches, because that match was fun. When I watch wrestling, I just want to have fun. Tell good stories, give me characters that I actually give a shit about, and all the pieces will fall into place. And they fell into place here on this show. So next weekend, we will do match number 7 on the top 8 countdown here. We're in the home stretch. We only got 2 more matches left. So that should be a lot of fun. Keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. And don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel for any Sound of extra videos that may go up, youtube.com/thesolemonster. You can make a PayPal donation to support the show on thesolemonster.com. Use our Audible link to get the Brock Lesnar book I talked about earlier, audibletrial.com/solemonster. Buy a shirt in our t-shirt store on prowrestlingtees.com/solemonster. Sounds off, over 20 shirts to choose from. Thank you, by the way, to all the people who were in Kalamazoo at the ROH taping the other night, apparently wearing Sound Off shirts. I saw a couple of photos of one of them. So thank you very much for that. Next weekend is the Halloween episode of the Sound Off, and 2 weeks is our 8-year anniversary show. So a lot of good stuff coming up. Go Mets, be well, stay safe, and we'll see you right back here next weekend. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemonster Sounds Off.
Watch these promos on NXT. Watch Raw. Watch a Randy Orton promo or a Sheamus promo. They never, ever look at the camera. It's because that's what they teach them now. You are not allowed to look into the camera. I think it's just completely idiotic. Why are their eyes not on me? That's how interviews always work. They're talking to me. They're speaking to us. They're supposed to be speaking to the fans. Maybe that's part of the reason why these people can't make a connection with the audience. Because they don't fucking look at us.
Solemonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, the Solemonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solemonster Sound Off.